I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. In this episode of The Unmistakable Creative, I speak with Tara Sophia Moore about why people play small and what helps us play big in our lives and careers from the inside out. And applications for our annual event, The Instigator Experience, are now open. If you're looking for an event that gives you a combination of action, education, and transformation, and a learning experience designed to help you create the best work of your life, visit theinstigatorexperience.com and submit your application today. It's that time of year when you're probably reflecting on this past year and setting goals for the new one. And a big part of accomplishing your goals is going to involve a combination of information and skills. Let's talk about SkilledUp, who's curated the best of online courses in alternative education and put it all under one roof to help you obtain the skills you need to succeed in your career. They even put together a free and really useful toolkit that you can download by visiting promo.skilledup.com/creative. That might have been a mouthful. So once again, that's promo.skilledup.com/creative. Tara, welcome to The Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. So, you know, I came across you by way of our former guest, Justine Musk and Peter Sims. And also, you were a former guest here as well when we were called Blogcast FM. And I know that you have a new book out called Playing Big, which is what prompted this conversation. But before we get into what that is all about, can you tell us a bit about your story, your journey, your background, and how that has brought you to what you're up to in the world today?
Sure. Well, I had a very unique childhood in that my mom was really interested in psychology and also in spirituality and in the mysticism aspect of many different religions. And I was fortunate in that she didn't have the assumption that so many parents do, that kids can't understand that stuff. So I was raised with analyzing my dreams at the breakfast table every morning with my mom from maybe age 5 or 6 on. She'd ask me, what was your dream? And we'd diagram it and talk about the symbolism. And you know, questions like, if I came home from school and said, I really think so-and-so is a dork. And I'm remembering one particular day where I got into the car and I said, so-and-so is a dork. And she said, Tara, how do you think God is looking at that person? So that's how I was raised. And it meant that I had a real interest in and kind of literacy with psychology and spirituality from a very young age, and loved that and found it to be an incredibly helpful way of navigating all the ups and downs of childhood and adolescence. And I also, from my early childhood, was very aware of, like, noticing, why are there no women? Why are we not reading any books by women in my English class at school? Why is it that when we go to synagogue, there's no women up in front leading the congregation? And feeling very pained by that and really wanting to somehow see that change. And so those interests and those loves have been with me for a long time and are still really at the center of what I do. But I also got very lost from those along the way, being in very competitive academic environments where certainly no one was talking about spirituality or psychology, and where my inner critic really started to take hold. So in a way, I've had a wandering path that has then led me back to work that's about those early loves.
So let me ask you this. A couple of questions come from this. One is around this idea of, you know, spirituality. How do you balance spirituality and practicality? Because I think that what I see in the world today often is that sometimes people will let the spiritual thing go so far that you're like, okay, so what the hell is it that you actually do?
Yes.
And I see a lot of that on the internet sometimes, and I'm just like, okay, like, I don't get, you know, like, it almost becomes a perfect avoidance mechanism for people. It's like, you know, I'm going to sit around and be spiritual all day, but I'm actually not going to do anything.
Yeah. You know, recently I was doing a workshop based on some of the material that's in my book, and the workshop was about the ways that we hide, and particularly the ways that I often see brilliant, creative people hiding, and we come up with brilliant hiding strategies because we need them in order to fool ourselves. Mm-hmm. And there was a woman in the group who, you know, raised her hand and asked me, well, but don't you think, as I was sort of really working with people about getting into action really quickly, and you know, but what about waiting for the universe to give you the right signs and, you know, trying to be in flow with that? And she was telling me about this project she had really wanted to start. And so first she went to a conference to see if she would, you know, happen to run into any of the right people she felt she needed on her team. She's like really looking for the serendipity and looking for these signs. And what came up for me when I was listening to her was, wait a second, but you are part of the universe. Like, even if we're in this philosophy that we need to wait to be aligned with the universe to do anything, you are part of the universe. And in my view, you'd be one of the most, you know, humans are one of the most densely packed, amazing parts of the universe that that we have. And so part of being aligned with the universe is being aligned with the voice in you that wants to go do something. Mm-hmm. So I think if that just, you know, speaks to that, that the way that we can use spiritual concepts to avoid facing our fears, mm-hmm. which we certainly can, and how we need to always be balancing real intellectual rigor and skepticism with spirituality. And I think we absolutely can. You know, to me, spirituality is not magical thinking. It's about love. It's about gratitude. It's about seeing and respecting the sacred in ourselves and in all life. Mm-hmm. And that's completely compatible with all the other stuff.
So let me ask you this. You know, one of the things you said was that after a certain point, you lost your way. And I'd be really curious about, you know, the journey to finding your way back, as well as how we do that in our own lives when we've lost our way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, for me, a lot of what caused me to lose my way was education, the educational environments I was in, where I often had a lot of trouble in the classroom, and I'm talking about, you know, college and then graduate school. I have an MBA in the classroom in a very secular, critical, competitive, and in the case of business school, very male dominated environment, finding my own voice and staying true to it. And also staying true to my creativity, my love of writing and dance and theater and poetry. And so for me, through that time, even though I, on the surface, everything looked fine, I was going to very prestigious schools, I was doing well in them, I was getting further and further from the real me. And I was feeling less and less alive, and I was feeling less able to have the kind of career I wanted. And so when I came out of graduate school, I took a job in a large foundation. It was sort of like a compromise job. It was like, well, we're doing something good for the world. It's in the nonprofit sector. I really liked my colleagues. I liked working with philanthropists and volunteer donors. But it was not creative, and it was not exciting. It wasn't what I really wanted to be doing. And what helped me find my way back was a lot of things. The first one is pain. You know, I often say to people, I wish that I changed in my life out of inspiration and sheer joy and hope. A lot of times when I really change, it's because the pain of the old way grows too intense to live with. And so for me, after I had been in that job for a few years, feeling so cut off from my creativity, feeling like, what happened to all those dreams I had of like having an entrepreneurial career and doing something in the media in some way, doing something creative, writing, what happened to all that? And why don't I like my life more? And I'm becoming a crankier and crankier person because I don't like it that much. that all the pain of that pushed me to be willing to do some things that felt uncomfortable. And actually, the first thing I did was hire a coach and go get trained to be a coach, because I just knew I wanted to go in the direction of doing some work in the personal growth sphere. And the coaching training, which I could do on the side of my job, was like a very low stakes way to start playing in that sandbox.
I'm really glad you brought up the idea of a low stakes way to start playing in the sandbox, because often people will hear a story like this and think that it just is, making this gargantuan leap. And suddenly mm-hmm. everything changes.
And I think a lot of times people think that's the brave thing to do, make a gargantuan leap. That's what I would do if I was truly free or following my passion. And I don't see it that way at all. I think the need that we have inside for stability, the desire we might have for financial stability, to be able to support the people that we love, that's just as important a desire as the desire to feel passionate about our careers. And it's really important to respect both in ourselves. So for me, I had a whole 2-year period where I was training to be a coach. I was coaching 3 or 4 or 5 clients in the evenings after work. I was blogging in the morning before work. So by the time I felt really inside, okay, I'm ready to leave this job and I feel like I'm leaving on stable ground, I had been writing for a year, blogging. I had some sense of who my clients were that were showing up in my coaching practice and what it would take to build the practice. So it felt like I was leaving on solid ground, and that was really important to me.
One thing that's interesting to me is that you brought up this idea of, your change actually happens because of pain. And I'm fairly convinced that that's almost universal for anybody who does something of significance. There's a moment that is incredibly painful, or several, that actually lead to sort of the next horizon and the next horizon and the next horizon. And, this question has come up for me multiple times, and I've asked it to a lot of people. Do you think that it's possible to experience drastic change without some sort of painful experience?
That's a great question. I don't know. I know it's certainly not how it happens most of the time in my life, I mean, I can mostly only speak to my own experience there. And I think about, in my relationship, my husband, who I'm madly in love with, we've been together since 1999, since we were in college. And right before I met him, I was in that same rock bottom place that has precipitated so many other changes. I was in that place around relationships. Why do I keep picking these jerks to go out with? What is my problem? What's my deal? And I was really in pain about how I had been in my relationships. I was sick of it. I was, literally sitting down with my friends who I felt were more wise in this area of their lives and being like, okay, just explain it to me. Explain it to me. How do you think about this? Give me your whole framework. Trying to learn a different way. So in a lot of areas of my life, there's a very powerful rock bottom moment. I'm really a fan of the rock bottom moments, because I think it's then that we start being open to a different way. It's often then that we surrender. I think one of the most power, and again, this would be part of my definition of spirituality, is when you say, I'm not getting it right. I can't do this by myself. I don't know. And I'm willing to open up my grip and put this in the hands of something greater than me, or remember that I don't have to figure it out on my own. I'm surrendering this. And that just creates an internal shift that allows us to act in new ways and be open to new possibilities, I think.
So how do you surrender as opposed to crack? Because some people crack in those moments. I know, because I have at times.
Well, I guess for me, the surrender is it's like the cracking plus the remembering that you're not alone in the universe. So it's, I'm bewildered here. I'm not getting this right. I can't do this on my own. I don't know. I'm turning it over. And it could be, you know, for people who have the sense of a more traditional higher power, maybe that's I'm turning it over to that higher power, or it's just like I'm turning it over to the greater intelligence of the universe. I'm turning it over to the force of life itself. I'm just turning it over. I'm surrendering this sense of trying to control it or do it all on my own. And I find that a lot of times, in some sense, that's all we have to do to start to bring some new possibilities into our field of vision.
I like that. Let me ask you this, and then we'll start really getting into playing big. You know, one of the things that's interesting is I'm listening to you tell this story. It seems like the work you do today is kind of the intersection of a lot of life experiences and career experiences that have resulted really in more of a calling than a career. And I'm, you know, and I've asked multiple versions of this question to other people. How do we find that intersection in our own work and our own lives?
Yeah, you know, I think, and this, I hope this is relevant and hopeful for a lot of your audience. Because I think it applies to many creative types, that in my experience, the things for me that felt like this really uncomfortable, like I don't fit into any category, or I have one foot in each of two different worlds. Like for me, it was, well, on the one hand, you know, I'm in this like very prestigious MBA program, but on the other hand, I'm like driving 3 hours on the weekend to go be a volunteer docent at like an obscure poet's stone tower by the ocean, literally, you know? And on, you know, or I'm doing, you know, corporate leadership training, but I'm like literally getting down on my knees before that and saying a prayer that I hope the training will like, you know, serve the force of life and love. So these things that for much of my life felt like these two things don't go together or made me feel like I didn't belong become the unique blend that makes my work distinctive for people now, or that makes it, oh, okay, I found someone who now combines these things that I've been trying to combine. So I think that can be true for a lot of us. It's like the different parts of us that made us feel like we couldn't, you know, the career counselor just didn't know what the hell to do with us, can actually become now what's distinguishing about our work and our voice.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears and let's get really into this idea of playing big and where it came from. And let's really get into the specifics of how this can be applied to our lives. Because, you know, when I sat down and you know, went through the index of the book and went through the table of contents and read, you know, several of the chapters, I thought, okay, you know what, there's a lot here.
Thanks. There's a lot. I sometimes feel like I think I could have done a book actually on each chapter in the book, and maybe I will in the future. But yeah, where do you want to jump in?
Let's start right at the beginning. I mean, you know, like where did the idea of playing big come from? And probably the biggest thing is, you know, what is it that keeps us from playing big? And, you know, how do we apply these concepts so that we can go out and play big?
Yeah. Well, so when I started my coaching practice, it was an interesting time where I was seeing the same thing in my coaching practice and in a lot of different areas of my life. And what I was seeing was brilliant women with a lot of talent, great ideas, who just couldn't see their own brilliance, weren't acting on their own brilliance. In the foundation where I was working, all these brilliant women leading at sort of the second tier lieutenant level in the organization, all the top leadership and all the big decisions being made by men. Among my friends, feeling like I had all these amazing women friends in my life who just, I wanted them to be shaping their fields and their companies in a much more powerful way than they were, in a way that they were ready to do and had the ideas to do but weren't doing. And then in my coaching practice, these great women would walk in and same kind of issue. And one day I sat down, I had been blogging for maybe a year and a half, and I had a particular client in mind, this young woman who was, every time we had a coaching session, I was just like, you are so amazing. You know, she's just like intuitive and wise and thoughtful and reading all the cutting edge research in her field and totally unable to believe in herself. And no one in her organization knew about her amazing strengths because she wasn't sharing them. And I sat down and sort of wrote the things I wished she knew about herself. And I wrote it as 10 kind of principles or things I wish she was doing. And I called the piece 10 Rules for Brilliant Women. And I knew it had, I was really nervous to publish it. At the time I was writing for Huffington Post and I was going to put it there. And it just felt, I was like scared because I knew I was really saying something in the piece. So it felt vulnerable. And I shared it and it went completely viral. And within a couple of months, I was on the Today Show. I was getting emails, can we translate this into this language and that language? You know, it really was striking a chord. And so that was a big clue to me, okay, there's this phenomenon of women not seeing their own brilliance, of brilliant women not seeing their own brilliance, which was really what the piece was about. And then I took that even further and was surveying my blog readers and asking them what the biggest challenge in their lives was and listed all the typical challenges we talk about in women's lives, but added this additional challenge that I called I'm playing small. That was the most succinct way I could sum up what I was seeing. And when the responses came back, that was what the most number of women said was the biggest challenge in their life, more than work-life family balance, more than financial challenges. So from there, I felt very clear that I wanted to focus my work here because I believe that we so need a balance of male and female leadership in the world. We so need both for lots of reasons, and that there's some inner work for many women to do in order to kind of leave behind the history of women's marginalization and really trust their voices and start sharing them much more boldly.
So a couple of questions come from this. You know, it's funny because I'm a guy and I read your book and I'm sitting here thinking, I'm like, this isn't just isolated to women in a lot of ways, you know?
Yes.
So one of the things you mentioned is people not being able to see their own brilliance. So two questions from that. One, what causes that, do you think, for people? And how do you overcome that?
Yeah, and I should say, you know, I completely agree that it's not just for women. And it's been interesting for me because I had a son, my first child, in the middle of writing this book. And I feel like that experience has made me feel even more that these ideas are for everyone. Like, there's a role in talking about them in terms of women, and there's different nuances of how they play out for men and women. Mm-hmm. But we're all playing small relative to our potential, for sure. So, you know, why can't we see our own brilliance? I think that, and this might sound surprising, given everything I just said, but what I've learned doing this work is that the answer to the problem isn't seeing our own brilliance. The answer isn't what we'd think of as a traditional sense of confidence. Because thinking about your own brilliance or your own lack of brilliance, either way, you're in your ego and it's unstable ground. The answer is basically falling in love with what you want to do or say, being so present to that, that that takes precedence. And so you're not really thinking about whether you're good enough or not. And so the process of getting there has a lot to do with, it's not about getting over self-doubt or graduating from self-doubt. It's about having a new relationship to your self-doubt, knowing self-doubt is always going to be there. I really believe that our inner critics are expressions of the instinct in us that wants to stay emotionally safe, and that when we're going out of our comfort zone, that safety instinct tries to get us to stay in the comfort zone by saying, no, 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 you're not qualified, you're going to make a fool of yourself, you don't do that, that's ridiculous, all the things our inner critics say. And so if that's true, then our inner critics are always going to be there. We're hardwired for them. And the work then is about being able to say, I hear that voice, I know it for what it is, and I'm going to take action anyway. For me, as part of the book launch, I wrote for the first time for the New York Times, wrote an op-ed, and that, for me, totally riled my safety instinct. Oh my God, it's going to be criticized. There's no way your work can translate to the New York Times. People who write for the New York Times sound grown up, and you don't sound grown up, so they're not going to take your piece, you know, all this stuff. And my job in that moment was not to try and get over that or to try and find a sense of confidence or feeling brilliant. It was to say, oh, that's my inner critic. I'm hearing my inner critic. It sounds like it's telling the absolute truth. And in this moment, I kind of even believe it is. But there's another part of me that knows the pattern of what the inner critic is and knows that this is not the truth. And therefore, hard as it is, I'm going to sit down and write this piece anyway.
So, you know, you mentioned this idea of a different relationship with self-doubt. So I guess that brings up two questions. How do you build a better relationship with your self-doubt? And how do you quiet the inner critic?
Yeah. So I think they're the same thing. And I think it comes from a few principles. One is knowing what your inner critic sounds like and being able to name it for what it is. And that's not easy because for most of us, our inner critic has come to take up so much space in our heads. We think it's just how we are. We're like that a lot of times when I'm, you know, teaching a workshop, other people say, well, that's not my inner critic card. That's just me. That's how my thoughts sound. I'm like, no, if the thoughts are like repetitive, anxious, irrational, and telling you everything that's wrong with you, that's actually not just you. That's your inner critic. So learning to identify that voice in your head. What are the common things it says to you? What are the new things it's saying to you now that you're stretching in a new direction? And in the book, I talk about some of the common qualities of that voice that we can help us, that help us recognize it. So when we can recognize it, then we can say, oh, I'm hearing my inner critic right now. And then that having that better relationship comes from, one, being able to be a witness but not take direction from it. And then, compassionately remembering what its motivations are, that it's coming from that safety instinct and trying to keep you safe. So my favorite thing to say back to my inner critic is like, thank you so much. And it's sincere. Thank you so much for trying to protect me here, but it's okay. I've got this one covered. So it's a very paternal or maternal, reassuring way of relating to that self-doubt, understanding the fear that's underneath it. It's not arguing with the self-doubt. It's not trying to kill it with positive affirmations. It's not getting angry at the inner critic. It's a very compassionate kind of response. And then there are also a lot of like more light tactical things you can do, like having a character that personifies your inner critic and kind of picturing the voice coming from that character that can add a lot of humor and sort of diffuse it. You can use some embodied tools like imagining that voice fading away out of the room, or actually getting up and moving it, you know, imagining pantomiming, kind of moving it to a new space, those kinds of things.
All right, everybody, let's take a quick break and thank today's sponsors. As I said at the beginning of the episode, it's that time of year when we need to be setting goals and determining what skills we'll need in order to accomplish those goals. That's where our sponsor for today's show, Skilled Up, comes in. Finding online courses in the areas you're interested in can be a real rabbit hole that causes you to waste a lot of time. Skilled Up curates the world of online and educational resources to bridge the gap between education and job skills. They put the best of all online learning under one roof, and online learning is flexible, self-paced, and affordable. They have courses in web design, photography, marketing, software development, business management, and much more. The bottom line is this: you have to keep improving your skills to navigate the world we live in today, and Skilled Up is a great place to do that. Acquiring new skills allows you to be more creative and build new things. They've also put together a free toolkit for innovative creators that you can download at promo.skilledup.com/creative.
So how do you take all of that, I guess, and actually translate it into, you know, actionable insight that leads to whatever your version of big is? And I mean, how do you explore, you know, what it means to play big for you?
Yeah, well, there's a couple lenses on in terms of defining what playing big means. First, my most succinct definition of playing big is it's being more loyal to your dreams than to your fears. So I find that, and for me, that piece really comes out of my own journey, where when I was starting to make my career shift, starting to reclaim writing for myself, what was so crystal clear to me was this feeling of, oh my gosh, I have dreams and I have fears. And right now, I've just been consistently siding with the fears. And if I keep doing this, I will get to the end of my life and be like, I lived a life based on my fears. So being more loyal to your dreams than your fears. And I think everyone knows, you know, when we get really honest with ourselves, we know something about what our playing big looks like. And it's self-defined. And, you know, a lot of times people ask me, well, how is your book different than Lean In? And it's different in a lot of ways. But one of them is that when women or men are defining playing big in this way, you know, it might look like climbing some career ladder. It might look like getting off the ladder. It might look like reclaiming a hobby or passion. It might look like taking on a leadership role in your community outside of work. So it's whatever playing big with your dreams really, really is. And then the two kind of lenses for digging into that. One is identifying what you feel called to, what your callings are, and we can talk more if you want about my framework about how you do that.
Yeah.
And then two, the inner mentor can show you a lot about what your playing big looks like. And the inner mentor is a vision of yourself 20 or 30 years in the future. And in the playing big program and then in the book, we get people to that vision through a guided meditation. But the basic idea is you're really relaxing, you're closing your eyes, you're envisioning a journey to meet yourself 20 or 30 years in the future. And when you do that in a right brain way, in a relaxed state, you don't just see your ego's fantasy of your miraculous perfect life in 20 years. You see something much more interesting, wise, and surprising than that. You know, I always say to people, if you weren't surprised by what you saw in your inner mentor vision, you didn't really get to your inner mentor, because it will always show you something your conscious mind wouldn't have planned. And then that figure really becomes like a guide, a mentor, a visual expression of your true essence. And I just can't say enough. I mean, what I've seen with people using that tool, it's just miraculous how people again and again will be in such confusion or, you know, just in a stuck place. And once they've done that initial inner mentor vision, at any subsequent point when they're in that stuck place or confusion, you can say, let's check in with your inner mentor. How would she see this? Or how would he approach it? And the answers they get back are just amazing, amazing, and beyond what any of us could ever come up with.
I love that. That's genius. So let me ask you this. You know, you talked about this idea of maintaining loyalty to your dreams as opposed to your fears. And How do we do that when you get very difficult, you know, sort of dark night of the soul moments when we're pursuing our dreams?
Say that again.
So I probably should ask that a little more effectively. So, you know, you talked about maintaining loyalty to your dreams as opposed to loyalty to your fears.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when we're loyal to our dreams, we get our asses handed to us, for lack of something less
cool. Yes.
So when that happens, how do you not return to maintaining to loyalty to your fears? Mm, does that make
yeah.
sense?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I love, it reminds me a lot of Elizabeth Gilbert's, one of her more recent TED Talks. I think she's done a few now, and she just talks about, you know, she just says, some of the books I write are going to fail, and some of them are going to succeed, and I'm going to keep writing books anyway because that's my home. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's interesting, right, because there's different ways we can get our asses kicked, and this goes a little bit to the part of the book that's about feedback and how we, you know, how do we, I'm sorry, how do we use feedback in a way that allows us to play big, and keep playing big. And one of the principles that I just believe in so strongly and that I share in the book and that people are finding quite controversial, which is fun, is that feedback can never tell you anything about yourself. It can only tell you about the person giving the feedback.
Wow.
And when I wrote that in my manuscript, you know, you can imagine how my editor from Penguin, who has made a lifetime career out of giving people feedback, how she responded to that idea. She crossed it out. And she said, Tara, don't you mean feedback doesn't only tell you about you? You know, it also tells you about the person giving the feedback. And I was like, no, I really mean the more radical version. I really believe that. So a lot of times when we get, you know, what you're talking about, the kinds of failures we experience, when we look at them as telling us about our audience, about our customers, about our investors, about our publisher, you know, wherever the failure came from, looking at it as not a verdict on us, our talent, our merit, our worth, but as telling us something about what works, what doesn't for that audience, what they're looking for, then it just becomes strategic information that we use in the next round of things. And we don't have to go on an ego roller coaster with it.
Wow. I never thought about it that way before. That's actually really, really useful.
Good. Yeah. I live by that and I find it so helpful. Hmm.
So, you know, earlier you mentioned that there was sort of a framework for exploring the calling. You talked about sort of the inner mentor, but there was some other piece of this as well. And I'd love to dig, you know, a bit deeper into that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I find in my own life, I get these callings and I see, you know, in the people I'm working with, the same patterns of how these callings show up. And another word I use for callings sometimes is assignments, because what I'm talking about is those things that come to us and we feel a little like we've gotten an assignment and we're not sure who gave us the assignment, but we don't quite feel like, oh, I chose to do this part. It just feels more like this is something I'm meant to do or assigned to do. A calling or an assignment being anytime we feel a sense of inspiration or longing to address a particular need in the world or enrich the world in some particular way. So it could be a calling to start a podcast, to launch a business, to help a particular person in your community who's having a tough time. It could be a calling to make a particular kind of art. Could be long duration or short. It could be in the realm of your career or in a different realm. And I think we all get lots of callings through our life. And so the question is not, what's my calling? Which is probably one of the most stressful questions we could ever ask ourselves. But what's calling me right now? Or what calling am I receiving right now? And so we're not trying to find the one right answer with our callings. We're trying to become human beings who are more responsive to and respectful of our callings, because we know that it will bring us great joy to pursue them. And a big misconception that people, I think, also have about our callings is that they'll feel awesome all the time when we're doing them, and that we'll feel, going back to our, you know, spiritual excuses, that if something doesn't feel resonant all the time, it's not a real calling. And in fact, one of the telltale signs of a calling is that we resist it. Usually our big callings, our most important ones, scare the heck out of us and feel like they're taking us way out of our comfort zones. And we will also usually feel like we don't have what we need to do the calling, and we're not the person we would need to be to do it well. And the cool part is that the calling actually grows us into that person. In other words, you know, it's not just our inner critic saying, but you're not whatever enough, patient, charismatic, whatever. It's actually usually true. We're not quite who we need to be to do our callings, but that's part of the role of the calling, is to grow us into that person.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because, you know, we had Julian Smith here recently, you know, back for a second time after, you know, spending years as a writer. He's now, you know, evolved into a CEO of a startup called Breather. And, you know, I asked him, he said, you know, when you wrote something like The Flinch, which he says is the best work of his life, I'm like, how do you do the best work of your life? And he said, with a tremendous amount of suffering and your back against the wall.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's an interesting blend, I find, of there are the moments of creative flow and, you know, of deep resonance when we're doing our right work. And that's not what it's like all the time. You know, there are moments of a lot of struggle. I'm just thinking now, you know, as I'm talking about this, that experience for me of doing the New York Times piece, which, you know, was such a mix of panic and hating it and 700 drafts and wrestling, you know, and moments of real flow. Which, by the way, as I'd like to share the happy ending of that story and how wrong my inner critic was, they did take the piece. They published it, and then it became the most emailed article of the week in the New York Times. Wow. So our inner critics don't always know what they're talking about.
Yeah. Really, really. That's this is just, you know, like I said, to me, there's so much here that I feel could be applied to just about any creative endeavor. And, I think it's interesting you brought up also that it's not always this place of just deep creative resonance, that it ebbs and flows. And I think the funny thing is, to the world outside, it can appear that way very easily.
Yes, yes. And we have that misconception, you know, and there's something, you know, I think it's important that there's been this whole raised awareness about, notice what kind of work makes you feel good and strong and puts you in flow. Like, that's important too, but we can take it too far. Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you this. I want to go back to something you said about Lean In and sort of the comparisons and people asking you what's different. And the reason this is just out of personal curiosity, this is fresh on my mind because we were, you know, I was with my friend and we were just talking about Lean In and, you know, whether that is really like the metric that, and I, you know, I'll confess, I haven't read Lean In, but I've seen a lot of criticisms of it too, about it being very, very type A. And I just kind of want to hear your perspective on, you know, sort of both sides of this. Like, again, I think that takes us between sort of the balance of spiritual, practical, and having some sense of balance in our lives, especially, you know, in Silicon Valley, where there's this like type A, you know, 100-hour a week, you know, culture, and winning at any cost.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's a tremendously important book. And when I was in business school, I was very involved with the women's organization at business school and organizing programming. And we always found that it was really, really hard to find any women business leaders who would talk explicitly about their experience as women, you know, stuff happening around gender in the business world. Like, the kind of culture was like, it is too costly for me to speak out about that. And if I'm a successful woman executive in business, like I'm basically going to, you know, I'm happy to show up and say, yeah, women can do it too, but I'm not going to talk to you about my experiences as a, you know, as a woman. I'm not going to talk about, I'm not going to make this my issue. And so I think there was a huge vacuum there and a huge need for someone in the corporate world to raise this conversation. And I'm really happy that Sheryl Sandberg's done that. I also think the book is extremely well written and well researched, and it's very interesting. Like when you look at what really happened, it's like it came out. There were a bunch of articles, kind of weirdly criticizing her for being a privileged woman giving advice, which you know both my husband and I were kind of laughing, like. Can you imagine if Warren Buffett wrote a book on investing and there were like articles being like, how can he write a book telling other people how to invest? Like he's a billionaire. That's so rude. You know, like it was a complete double standard. And then, you know, the book has been on the bestseller list for years because women are actually finding it helpful and, you know, word of mouth. You can't sustain that through publicity or title. Mm-hmm. So all of that. And I know that for a lot of women who aren't in the corporate world, there's a need for other flavors of not just other flavors, but content that's about how they can make the contribution they want to make and lead in the way they want to lead. All of that is just happening in a very different context. And the other thing I'll say is. Where my passion really lies, specifically around women's leadership, is, but really, I guess the same is true about men playing big. You know, I want people to share their voices in order to change the status quo. I think our systems need a lot of changing, and so my model is much more centered on. Playing big, not within the systems as they are, and just being more successful within them, but how do you play big so you can change them?
I love that idea of sharing your voice to change the status quo. I think that's what's going to be the title of the interview.
Mm.
You know, as I've sat here and chatted with you, I can't help but think that this isn't just about work.
For me?
Like, the entire concept of playing big.
Yeah. Oh no, not at all. Not at all. And you know, like I always think about one woman who took my course and said, you know, I took it for my business, but then right in the first few weeks of it, my father went into hospice and I found that what we were learning every single week where I ended up applying it was in speaking up for myself and for him because he and the other residents in this hospice program, we're not getting the care they deserve. Hmm. And everything I learned about, you know, what is my inner critic saying to try and shut me up? What would my inner mentor say in this situation? How do I deal with unhooking from praise and criticism so I can say things that aren't going to be well-liked? She used all of that in that situation. And I was so touched by that, you know, that application of it. So, yeah, it's not. It's about, you know, it's about freeing your voice and unleashing your brilliance and your light throughout your life.
You know, it's interesting when your work gets used in ways that you might never imagine it to be used in contexts in which it may never be used. I remember, you know, a parent emailed me and said, I've been using your podcast as part of our homeschool curriculum
for our kids. Well, not to mention our friend Glenn Beck, too. He used it in a way you didn't imagine.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Tara, this has been really, really eye-opening and insightful. So I want to close with my final question. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
That they have listened inward to find out what they have to say and contribute rather than looking over their shoulder, comparing, seeing what everyone else is doing. Hmm.
Well, I think that makes a beautiful way to wrap up our conversation. Tara, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share some of your insights and your story with our listeners here at The Unmistakable Creative.
Thank you. This has been such a pleasure. I really enjoyed it, and I'm grateful to you for hosting me today and to everyone for listening.
My pleasure. And for those of you guys listening, I will link up everything Tara mentioned in the show notes. Got myself a copy of the book. I can't recommend it highly enough, and we'll wrap the show with that.
If you like what you heard, the greatest compliment you could give us is to share the show with a friend and let people know what you think by leaving a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening to The Unmistakable Creative.